Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Half of all unemployed people say they've suffered from anxiety or depression. More than half have borrowed money from friends or relatives. Three-quarters of major cities reported a rise in family homelessness. Almost all have seen a huge increase in the demand for food assistance.
My life is full of empty promises and broken dreams. I'm hoping things look up, but there ain't no job openings.
When you lose everything and become homeless, hopelessness follows. So what happens for me is that I start to feel like there is no hope. And then, why bother?
Rock bottom. It's a dangerous and scary place. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 15th, and The Takeaway for me is 15 million people, almost 15 million people, who now find there are holes in the social safety net.
That's the raw number of unemployed in America,
and it's
a shock how sometimes invisible they seem. We're going to try to shed some light on that rock bottom place. But first, let's get right to it. In the headlines, everything you need to know. It looks like the plan to expand Medicare couldn't escape the chopping block. The idea of letting people aged 55 to 64 buy into Medicare was dropped by Democratic senators last night, one day after it drew fire from some moderate Democrats. Majority Leader Harry Reid is trying to hold his caucus together.
We have gone over most of the hurdles. It's like a steeplechase race. Last big puddle's in front of us. We'll jump over that and we'll be to the finish line.
Well, wading through that puddle will be President Obama and all of the Senate Democrats. They're going to meet later today to discuss ways of passing a bill by Christmas. They're leaving Guantanamo, possibly heading to the heartland. The White House is expected to announce today it plans to use a state prison in rural Illinois to house about 100 suspected terrorists now being held in Cuba.
A series of car bombings have rocked Kabul and Baghdad this morning. In Kabul, the bomber struck near the home of a former Afghan vice president, killing at least eight. Earlier, we spoke to BBC correspondent Martin Patience in Kabul, who says the strikes were meant to send a clear signal.
It sends a message, a clear message to Afghans that simply nowhere in the country is safe and that the insurgents can simply almost strike at will anywhere of their choosing.
In Baghdad, a series of explosions went off minutes apart near the heavily guarded Green Zone, killing five and wounding dozens more. Here at home, a New York Times poll shows the recession is having a traumatic effect on many Americans, and unemployment is forcing more people into homeless shelters for the first time. We're joined now by Kevin Roach. He's the executive director of the South Oakland Shelter in Royal Oak, Michigan. Kevin, you have 30 beds in your mission. Is that usually enough to shelter the people who come to your doors?
Definitely not, Celeste. What we've seen in the last year or so is that the 30 beds are vastly inefficient to meet the increasing number of those individuals and households who are experiencing homelessness throughout the Southeast Michigan region. And definitely what we've seen in the past year or so is that changing face of homelessness, which of course, includes a sharp increase in the number of women and children who are experiencing homelessness, as well as those who are experiencing homelessness for the very first time. Hmm. Roughly this past year, it's been about 45% of all of our clients who were first-time homeless.
And nothing invisible about any of those people you serve, right, Kevin?
Definitely not, John.
Okay, Kevin, stay with us. We'll talk with you more in just a moment. Taking a quick look at the markets, Asian markets ended lower. European indices are mixed, though. Wall Street futures down. The Dow will get underway at 10,501. The S&P opens at 1,114. The NASDAQ at 2,212.
We've got a lot for you this morning. Coming up, how you can turn a seasonal job into a permanent one. It's a challenge, but you can do it. We're going to talk about your work life every Tuesday and get tips from one temp employee who turned company CFO. That's later this hour. And all this week, we're talking about reading between the lines for our series Life in Fine Print. Today we talk about the little fees that add up to a lot of cash.
The idea of the fine print is not to help the customer. The idea of the fine print is to be able to hide things that will fool people.
Fight back against fine print. Listen to The Takeaway. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And coming up, we talk about that social safety net, how it's getting stretched to the brink and making it more visible in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Half of all unemployed people say they've suffered from anxiety or depression during the past year. 25% of them have applied for food stamps. 1/5 have visited a food bank. Those are some of the results from a new New York Times survey of unemployed Americans. And it's a place, John, where statistics, you almost, they kind of pass over my head. They seem so surprising to me.
Numbers conceal more than they reveal, I think, ultimately.
Sometimes they really do. You have to stop and really examine each one of them and see what that means. We are joined by James Forestieri. He's been homeless and living at the Bowery Mission in Manhattan for the past 6 months. He rejoins us. We spoke with you before, James. We wanted to get an update on how things are for you. You've been unemployed for 6 months, but you've gone through the program at the Bowery Mission, and you're now ready to find a job,
right? That's correct.
How are things?
Things are good. I feel pretty optimistic.
You do?
I do.
But you hear what I just said about the results of this poll of unemployed people, that many of them suffered anxiety, depression. Does any of that surprise you? Does that sound pretty familiar to the situation you've been in?
It does. It does. It doesn't surprise me one bit. I see a lot of people every day at the mission that need help. But it doesn't overwhelm me. It doesn't deter me. I think what the Bowery Mission does so well, like other faith-based organizations, through their program, not only did they give you the skills to seek employment, but they instill hope. So I think that, you know, from a state, like I said last time, from coming from an overwhelming sense of hopelessness to go through a program to learn some more job skills on top of the ones that I have and be guided and encouraged and given hope. Puts me in a position now, sitting here, that I'm pretty optimistic about going back into the workforce.
Well, you're one of the lucky ones who found a shelter and there was a place for you. We're rejoined by Kevin Roach, the executive director of the South Oakland Shelter in Royal Oak, Michigan. Kevin, there's not always places for everyone who needs shelter and needs encouragement.
Definitely. I think that's what we have seen in this past year, is just a sharp increase in the number of those who are seeking shelter and other services, but unfortunately many homeless shelters and other human service providers are unable to really adequately meet that sharp increase that we've seen in this past year, definitely.
Kevin, you described the people who come into the shelter there in Michigan as shell-shocked. Can you tell me what you mean by that?
Definitely. I think what we were really talking about earlier was this fact that we are definitely seeing a different face of homelessness, a changing face of homelessness, kind of away from what we typically think are the stereotypes surrounding homelessness, that we have seen this shifting face of homelessness, which includes those individuals who are women and children, households experiencing homelessness, as well as those who are experiencing homelessness for the very first time. And that, of course, comes with it a dramatically different approach that we have to take. They're not used to the services. They're not used to being in this type of a situation. They are coming to us traumatized, shell-shocked, unsure of what to do or where to go or who to talk to or any of those other services that are offered, just because they've never had to do it before. And that has, of course, forced the social workers at my agency to dramatically shift and alter their approach and, of course, meeting their needs.
These are people that you describe it as having worked for maybe Ford or Chrysler for years, no criminal record, no substance abuse problems, the unemployment ran out, they've lost their homes to foreclosure. And I'm wondering, for those people who come in, there's an added issue of guilt.
Absolutely.
That
absolutely.
They feel like
and shame and feel like failures, and that's why I think there's the increase in depression, because I know that in my life, when I've so-called lost everything and hit a bottom, and ended up homeless, the overwhelming sense of how did I get here? How did I get here? What happened? And what can I do now? And in that, it's hard to see your way out of it. It's hard to see how I can move forward, how I could come out of the current condition that I was in. That's why I think that being in a place like the Bowery Mission helped me so much, because they showed me the way out.
Okay, we're joined now by Andrew Stettner. He is with the National Employment Law Project. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
This is not a problem in Brooklyn, and it's not just a problem in Michigan, right? This is the U.S. Conference of Mayors saying that 22 out of 23 cities they spoke to had an increase in requests for food from families.
When you have 1 out of 10 adults at least some measures, one out of six out of work. It's a national crisis. People have been out of work so long that whatever personal and family resources they had has been stretched to bear. What's interesting about this poll is it does show the safety net is responding in better than it did, let's say, example, in the severe 1980s recession. More workers are getting help from unemployment or food stamps, health care. But what's very interesting to me, this poll comes out just at the time when Congress is deciding whether to pull the plug on the kind of assistance that's been available. And if anything, this poll should just really show that we really have to do more, not less, to support the jobless.
Well, political tough times, Andrew. But let's talk about some of the things that Kevin and James were referring to a moment ago, this sense of being shell-shocked. How difficult is it for people to become self-advocates and to really demand rightful services, things that are available to them through the safety net as a way of keeping their families healthy and keeping them away from rock bottom?
Most of these folks have been self-reliant their whole life, have never had to ask for help from their family, for one sense, or even our government, for sure. And so this is a complete new experience for people. It's overwhelming. You know, these offices are in parts of town or with people that you have never interacted with before. So there, you know, there is huge barriers to getting assistance. You know, and for those of us, it's not hard to imagine, for those of us whose identity is wrapped up in going to work, playing by the rules, to have the rug pulled under you, it's very hard not to blame yourself, even if you're not to blame.
Andrew Stettner, you told one of our producers that you had a question for John Hocken, my co-host, John Hockenberry, if you saw him at a cocktail party. What was that question?
Well, I would ask John, you know, what is it about America when we can have so many adults out of work and the nation just appears to be going about its business, and it's not a national priority to address this?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think we explore this every day on the program. I think part of it is the disparity of who's employed, who's not employed, who's wealthy, who's not wealthy. I mean, there are enormous disparities in the United States, and they become existential disparities where people are living in two different nations in this country sometimes. I don't know if that's you're closer to the ground than I am, Andrew.
Well, what's surprising about that is it does seem like everybody knows someone who's out of work. I mean, it's stretched further and deeper into all different stratas of society. You know, I think we just have such a culture that we think that everyone can do it on their own, that the economy will recover on its own. And so we're just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. But that just may not be enough this time.
Andrew Stettner is the Deputy Director of the National Employment Law Project. Also, Kevin Roach from the South Oakland Shelter in Royal Oak, Michigan, joined us. And again, our friend James Forestieri, living at the Bowery Mission in Manhattan for the past 6 months. Thanks to all of you. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on headlines.
Andrew really put it to me there. Anyway, faced with a self-imposed Christmas deadline, President Obama plans to meet with Senate Democrats to talk about health care reform and passing a bill. Meanwhile, the president visits Virginia today to push a plan to make homes more energy efficient. They're doing that with buildings here in New York. New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg is at the Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen and talked about his program in New York City.
We just passed a green buildings bill, which will require, for example, landlords to post what the energy uses in their buildings are on the internet.
You can hear the entire interview we did with Mayor Mike Bloomberg of the City of New York on our website, thetakeaway.org.
Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen says most of the 30,000 additional troops being sent to Afghanistan will probably arrive by August. Mullen is visiting Afghanistan, where today he toured U.S. bases and a small village. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning. Coming up, news from the Philadelphia Phillies with our sports correspondent, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now some time for takeouts on stories that we're following this week. Good morning to both our Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick, and our Takeaway Sports contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
We've got breaking stories.
We do have breaking news, Todd. The White House expected to announce today that they will use a state prison in Illinois. It's about 150 miles outside Chicago, and they're going to house a number of terrorist suspects that are in Guantanamo. And from what I understand from the Chicago Sun-Times, it looks like not all of the remaining 200 Guantanamo Bay detainees will go to Illinois. Less than 100 of them. What other details do we have about this?
Well, up to 100 is what we're understanding this morning. The White House, Celeste, is set to announce this today. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn will be in town. Senator Dick Durbin, who's the number two ranking Democrat in the Senate, who's been an advocate of this all along, who, you know, back when members of Congress were ranting and raving about closing Guantanamo Bay and what's the plan, Mr. President, Durbin was the one saying Illinois would love to have them. So I guess this was all part of the script. About 210 detainees in Gitmo now, and up to 90 of them have already been scheduled to be transferred either back to their home countries or to third-party countries. So a little under half would be available to be transferred to Gitmo. Maybe up to 100. It depends on how many they determine that prison can hold.
Well, the Bureau of Prisons from Illinois would still keep control of about 75% of the facility, as I understand it, and the Department of Defense would take over a quarter of the facility. We actually spoke with Representative Mike Boland, who's a Democrat whose district includes this prison area, and he talked about this to us last month about how he was anxious for these jobs.
This will actually bring in over 3,000 jobs. And also, there'll probably be about 1,000 additional jobs in schools and restaurants and motels and other ancillary economic development.
We have heard the same kind of comment from the governor of Illinois and the Senator Dick Durbin as well, but there's been pushback from Republicans, which I expect will continue in wake of this announcement.
It will. There's been some pushback from Democrats, too, mostly from Republicans. You know, it's hard to say no to 3,000 jobs. You heard the congressman there, and the governor feels the same way. But there is going to have to be a little bit of work done in Congress. The Senate just last week, Celeste, passed language as part of a military funding bill that says explicitly no detainees can be transferred to the continental United States, Alaska, or Hawaii except to be prosecuted. Now, the president has said that not all of these detainees who go to Thompson Correctional Facility in Illinois would necessarily be prosecuted. Now, the House hasn't passed this language yet, but it shows that once the White House makes this announcement, they're going to have to go to Congress and make sure that this specific language barring detainees from being transferred to Illinois or anywhere else in the U.S. is stripped out, or else they're going to have legal impediments to either doing it or spending money on it.
Well, I'm sure we'll get more details as this announcement comes down the pipeline. Thanks, Todd.
The AP describes that Thompson Correctional Facility is in a sleepy rural part of Illinois. Not sleepy anymore, that's for sure. Speaking of wake-up calls, though, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor, somebody wants to go to the World Series.
Swing and a miss. Big-time punch-out for Roy Halladay.
Roy Halladay wants to sign with a championship team. What's going on, Ibrahim?
So last week, the baseball's had its winter meetings.
Right.
And last week, the New York Yankees made some big moves and got some players, and everyone else was quiet. So who's making moves now are their major competitors, which include the Philadelphia Phillies, who multiple sources are saying they signed the Toronto pitcher, Roy Halladay.
The hugest pitcher.
He's the biggest pitcher. And we spent a lot of last year worrying about where he was going to go, because Toronto is not a contender, and he wants to play for a contender. So partly he took what could have been a pay cut in a sense and agreed to go to the Phillies in a three-team trade involving the Toronto Blue Jays, the Philadelphia Phillies, and the Seattle Mariners.
And Roy Halladay, fantastic pitcher, goes from Toronto to the Philadelphia Phillies. He'll be out of the American League East, so the Yankees won't face him in the regular season.
However, which is interesting, the Phillies, for a couple of years, have had a philosophy of building an AL, or American League-type team, in the National League, so that they compete when it gets to the World Series. What this does is bolster their pitching rotation, so if whoever faces them in the World Series is going to have a serious challenge.
So you're liking this move. The California Angels are also really active.
The Angels picked up the World Series MVP, Hideki Matsui. Hideki Matsui, part of the deal, he said that he would be able to play outfield. And this might be the first winter where he's not getting knee surgery. So the Yankees might have slipped and let one go on this one.
That's right. After that performance in the World Series, Hideki Matsui is beloved here in New York.
Without a doubt.
Sad.
No one will ever forget him.
Two words on that football game last night.
You can't win. Don't play championship quality football when you have seven turnovers. And that's what the Arizona Cardinals had last night in their 24-9 loss to the San Francisco 49ers.
Mike Singletary's got a smile on his face, and Kurt Warner does not. Indeed. Absolutely. Thank you, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen.
Good morning.
And our last takeout comes from you, the listeners. We've been talking a lot about freelancers recently and how piecing together a living can take its toll on you personally. Peter writes his story to our site, thetakeaway.org. He says, as a freelancer, I found it's nearly impossible to get a mortgage. If you're a freelancer, they require 2 years of tax returns to approve net income, and freelancers expense almost everything to reduce their tax liability. On the other hand, if you have a permanent job, all they want is an offer letter and a pay stub, and no proof of income history beyond 30 days. Refinancing is simply not an option for many people simply because of this requirement.
Huh. You're a freelancer, aren't you, Ibrahim?
Pretty free.
Yeah, pretty free, yes, indeed. Here's an anonymous email we got from someone on the difference between having a full-time and a freelance job. This listener worked in an IT division of a law firm, both as a contract worker and a staffer. This listener's takeaway, my conclusion is that the headaches experienced when one is a regular employee give you a little more strength in the situation. When I worked as a consultant, I was incredibly vulnerable because the companies I worked for were not obligated to any employee handbook or contract.
Interesting.
All week long, we're talking about the devil's in the details, whether you're a freelancer or someone with a bank account, how the fine print at the bottom of your credit card statement or mortgage agreement can have gigantic consequences for you later on. Have you been burned? What's your strategy for dealing with the fine print? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up?
No public option. No Medicare buy-in.
The beloved senator from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, and his political travails coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, a profile of Senator Joe Lieberman and his party of one, or his apparent party of one in the U.S. Senate. Is it about revenge, or does he have some political brilliance? We're going to have a profile of him in just a moment. But let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour, including the health care reform proposal that Joe Lieberman is right in the center of. The proposal to expand Medicare appears to be drowning in the Senate. The idea of letting people aged 55 to 64 buy into the Medicare program was reportedly dropped during a closed-door meeting between Democratic senators last night. Even with all the setbacks, Majority Leader Harry Reid says,
really, it's been worth it. Tough race, but it's been worth it. American people waited a long time, and you've heard us say that, for health care reform.
President Obama will meet with every Senate Democrat later today to discuss ways to pass a health care bill by Christmas. For the first time since the two-week conference began, law enforcement officers in Copenhagen have used tear gas to disperse crowds of rioters. Nearly 200 arrests were made overnight as protesters angered by the lack of progress in the talks set fire to makeshift barricades.
This comes as heads of state and government have begun to arrive as the conference winds down this week. Early this morning, we spoke to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's in Copenhagen. He told us cities need to lead by example.
It is incumbent on our federal government to do something, but it's the cities where the mayors have to make sure that their economies aren't choked by congestion. It's the cities where the mayors have to make sure that the public doesn't have to breathe pollutants in the air into their lungs.
You can hear that entire interview with Mayor Michael Bloomberg at our website, thetakeaway.org. And the White House will announce today, it'll announce plans to use a state prison in Thompson, Illinois, which is about 150 miles outside Chicago. That'll become the new home for about 100 suspected terrorists now being held in Guantanamo Bay. It's a major step toward closing down the Cuban detention facility. Wall Street futures are down. The Dow will get underway at 10,501, the S&P at 1,114, and the NASDAQ at 2,212. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, we've just reported there will be a meeting at the White House between Senate Democrats and the president about what to do on health care reform to try to get a bill passed by Christmas. That's the president's interest. But certainly the first shot was fired once Harry Reid announced that he had something of a deal on health care reform. The first shot was fired by Joe Lieberman, who spoke over the weekend.
It will add taxpayer costs. It will add to the deficit. It's unnecessary.
The way the U.S. Senate works, one senator can be incredibly influential. An independent Joe Lieberman, who may have some axes to grind with the Democratic leadership, certainly wants to slow down, if not stop, this health care reform proposal in the Senate. What are his aims here? What's he trying to accomplish? What's in it for Joe Lieberman? Is he simply holding the bill hostage? What's going on here? That's an interesting political story. It involves the state of Connecticut. It involves someone who burst onto the national scene when he became something of the conscience of Bill Clinton, you may recall, back in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky days. David Kirkpatrick joins us, New York Times Washington correspondent. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Also with us is Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist and host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Connecticut Public Broadcasting. Good morning, Colin.
Good morning.
So, David Kirkpatrick, how significant do you think Joe Lieberman is in this health care reform stalemate or slowdown, whatever you want to call it, in the Senate? And what is he holding out for here, do you think?
Well, I interviewed him yesterday afternoon, and I have to say he looked really delighted with himself. At that time, this was before Senator Reid and the other Senate Democrats had given in on dropping this idea of expanding Medicare, any kind of expanded government insurance program. Senator Lieberman at that time had said, look, if you do this, you lose me, I'm going to vote against it. And according to him, he had sat over the weekend, he'd sat across a table, basically, from Senator Reid and the other Senate Democratic leaders, as well as three top White House officials, and they'd said to him, well, Joe, what do we need to do to get your vote? And he'd kind of drawn a line in the sand. And I thought, well, goodness, this gentleman feels very powerful and is feeling like he's on top of the world. And then, lo and behold, later that night, it came to pass. They had indeed dropped the Medicare proposal just as he had demanded. So he seems to be quite powerful. I think he, so far, it looks like Joe Lieberman won, everyone else nothing.
Colin McEnroe, is this revenge of the Jedi, kind of a personal sort of revenge from the Democrats' response to Joe Lieberman's support of John McCain in the campaign? Or does he win something in Connecticut for this?
I don't think he won anything in Connecticut for this. I mean, except among a certain percentage of the voters who there is a certain percentage of the voters, as there would be anywhere, who admire Joe Lieberman as a guy who stands up for what he believes in and you know, can't be cowed by anybody. But I don't think that that is substantively his profile here in Connecticut. I have to say that of all the things that I thought I was going to wind up being an expert on in my adult life, the idea that I have a doctorate in Lieberman studies is kind of depressing to me.
Oh, cheer up, Colin. You're hot today.
David, I have to ask, you know, this strategy from the Democrats has made somebody like Lieberman incredibly powerful, as John said in this debate. And I have to wonder, you know, the Republicans used budget reconciliation in 2001, 2003, 2005 to pass all kinds of stuff. The Democrats are in the majority. Instead of kowtowing to Lieberman, why don't they use their majority?
Well, the details of how reconciliation will work are very complicated, and it's hard to really be sure of its actual plausibility. I think right now it's quite useful as for the Democrats as a threat. Getting it done would be tricky. I think what Harry Reid is actually doing here is a kind of a reverse auction. He came into the room and started with the most liberal possibility that he could imagine, and he's been lowering that bar until he picks up another senator. You know, it's like, okay, I don't hear 10, how about 9? Okay, how many people will go for 8? All right, let's lower it to 7. And we just saw that drop one more step last night,
right,
to get Senator Lieberman back on board. The thing about Senator Lieberman is he is his public profile is very Republican. He won election with a third of the Democrats in the state and three-quarters of the Republicans, and that's pretty much the way polls show his approval ratings going. So he's going to continue to have a very difficult time winning a nomination in the Democratic column, and he's going to have a pretty easy time winning a nomination if he were to choose in 2012 to run as a Republican.
Right. David, a quick detail, though, on this issue of the compromise that Harry Reid has dropped, that Medicare will not be extended to people who are age 55. That's really what this is all about. Senator Lieberman actually supported this as recently as a few months back, which, you know, it makes me think that he's kind of cynical in all of this. But there's also a report this morning that the White House wants this compromise out as well. Is it possible that the White House is behind this ultimately?
Well, as I said, Sunday afternoon, 2:30, Senator Reid's office. The scene there is Senator Lieberman negotiating simultaneously with not only Senator Reid, but also Rahm Emanuel and two folks from the White House. So as of Sunday, I mean, the White House was working very closely with Reid on all of this and was negotiating right alongside him with Senator Lieberman. But yes, you are right. Just 3 short months ago, Senator Lieberman appeared to be endorsing this very idea. And so I think that is puzzling quite a few Senate Democrats. I mean, is it principle? Is it policy? Is it spleen? Very hard to tell what is motivating Senator Lieberman here.
Well, let's take it right to Dr. McEnroe with your doctorate in Lieberman studies. What is it? Is it spleen? I mean, he's always talking about bipartisanship and improving the status of government. This seems like a very cynical move on his part against everything he believes in.
He likes to be relevant. This, you could go all the way back to the Clarence Thomas nomination, where he was the final nay vote after campaigning pretty strongly for Thomas. one of the things he really likes to do is argue one way and then at the end vote another way, so that when somebody actually charts his voting record, they get kind of a misleading picture. But he loves to be Hamlet, and he's been doing this for a long time. And if he has to keep moving the goalposts in order to keep himself relevant, I do think that's a big part of his psychology. I don't think it's the only thing, the only reason he does stuff like that, but it's a big part of it.
All right, Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist and host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Connecticut Public Broadcasting. Also, David Kirkpatrick, thanks to you, New York Times Washington correspondent, talking about the relevance, the struggle to stay relevant, not much of a struggle for Senator Joe Lieberman, independent from Connecticut, in the health care reform debate. Coming up, how can you turn that seasonal job into a full-time one? How can you take over the company from being a Christmas elf? We'll talk about your work life every Tuesday, and we've got some tips coming up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You're listening to the rumbling sound of the Trans-Asia Express. It takes about 3 days to get from Tehran to Istanbul. And John Line joins us now, BBC Tehran correspondent, who's been reporting on the refugee situation in Turkey as people leaving the turmoil in Iran go to Turkey and find that they're certainly still under the thumb of Iranian authorities. So, John Line, first of all, good morning.
Yes, hello to you.
What are the voices that you've been talking to about the situation? Who are the people who are coming across the border, and how vulnerable are they when they get to Turkey?
It's not a mass exodus, but there are a lot of people leaving who are people who've been involved in the political process there, opposition activists, journalists, and sometimes people who just got caught up. For example, I met in one of the towns where people waiting for political asylum are kept in Turkey. I met one woman whose family owned a shop on one of the main streets in Tehran, Valiasa, and they'd taken some protesters in during a demonstration. They just kind of let them in when the security force was chasing after them. Unfortunately, they had an uncle who was in the intelligence service, and as a result, they'd been shot to the authorities, and they'd had to flee the country. I met other people. I met a young woman, Mariam, who said that she'd been arrested memorial for, if you remember, Neda Aga Sultan,
sure, that was
woman
the
who was shot dead.
The woman who was shot, and you saw the blood coming out of her on television, right? Live television.
That's right. And the 40th anniversary of her death, there was a big ceremony at her graveside. And then, of course, the security forces swept in on that. And this young woman said she ran with everybody, but unfortunately she tripped over a tombstone and she got caught. She got taken to one of the prisons. She doesn't know where the prison was. She told me how she described how she went down endless flights of steps. So obviously it was some great subterranean dungeon, interrogated for several days. And then eventually she said she was raped by her interrogator. Just a young 21-year-old woman raped by her interrogator repeatedly, and told that that was their kind of revenge for her efforts to get her vote back, as the demonstrations have been calling for.
Now, we've heard numerous reports of people either in these demonstrations or after these demonstrations having all kinds of brutal treatment at the hands of Iranian authorities. How does this woman, Mariam Sabri, that you just described her story, how did she get into Turkey from Tehran?
Well, she was released by the authorities after she'd been held in prison, but they threatened her not to speak to anybody under threat of death. And they wanted her to work for them, actually, but she refused to do that. She managed to get on a bus, and she said she managed to sneak out of the country when the guy checking passports at the border was half asleep in the middle of the night. But she's still afraid that the authorities are after her in Turkey. She thinks people are following her in Turkey, and she says her family's been taken and threatened and even beaten about a bit, still in Iran itself.
And indeed, that sense of paranoia comes through really loud and clear in this voice of someone who didn't even want to use his name when you spoke with him. Listen to this, John.
They have a list, you know. The police has a list of every activist in elections with address, telephone, cell phone. But some of them live hidden, for example, like me.
John Line, is Turkey supporting these refugees? Quickly, before we go.
Turkey is not quite a safe haven. The people there, the Iranians there, believe that they're being possibly chased down even within Turkey. I think Turkey's caught in the middle there, allowing these people to stay while they apply for political asylum.
John Line, BBC Tehran correspondent. Thanks for that.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, if you're getting a seasonal job, is it possible you could turn that temporary gig into a full-time permanent position? Takeaway contributor Beth Kobliner says you can, and we'll tell you how in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The president visits Virginia today to push his plan to make homes more energy efficient. The president says doing so will create jobs and save people more money on their energy bills. Meanwhile, New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg is also talking energy efficiency. He's at the Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. Earlier on the Takeaway, he said New York City is doing its bit to combat climate change.
We just passed a green buildings bill, which will require, for example, landlords to post what the energy uses in their buildings are on the Internet.
That's the mayor of New York City, Mike Bloomberg, speaking to us earlier from Copenhagen. You can hear that entire interview on our website, thetakeaway.org. Staying overseas, a wave of car bombings have rocked Kabul and Baghdad this morning. In Baghdad, a series of explosions went off minutes apart near the heavily guarded green zone, killing five and wounding dozens more. And in Kabul, Afghanistan, a suicide car bomber struck near the home of a former Afghan vice president, killing eight people and wounding at least 40. Earlier today, the BBC's Martin Patience described the scene from Kabul.
Well, this explosion ripped through a quiet neighborhood at about 9:30 local time. Now, that neighborhood is where many senior Afghan and Western officials live. It's also got some NGO headquarters and hotels. Now, a total of eight people were killed in the attack. Four of them were women. And while it's not clear who or what was the intended target, as you mentioned, the former vice president, Ahmed Zia Massoud, lives on the street. He could well have been the target, although nobody's claimed responsibility for this attack. And two of his bodyguards were actually amongst the casualties during this, what is the latest attack in a series of attacks inside Kabul over recent months.
It would appear that this is yet another attack that's meant to shake up the idea that even high-level targets, people living in quiet neighborhoods, as you said, are not safe.
Very much so. I mean, the insurgents set off these bombs to create instability. They want a vacuum because they thrive in that. And then the Afghan government, because of the instability, it can't do its job. So certainly this is part of the insurgency strategy. They want to cause chaos. And particularly if you attack inside the capital, Kabul, which until about 6 months ago had been regarded as relatively safe, it's picked up in the media. It sends a message, a clear message to Afghans that simply nowhere in the country is safe and that the insurgents can simply almost strike at will anywhere of their choosing.
Martin Patience joined us from Kabul. He's a correspondent with our partner, the BBC.
In other headlines, President Obama meets with Senate Democrats on health care reform. Just out this hour, wholesale inflation rose more than expected last month, led by a surge in energy costs. And congrats to the Postal Service. The busiest mailing day of the year was yesterday. Monday's volume hit 830 million pieces of mail. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's Tuesday and time to talk about work on The Takeaway. We're joined again by Beth Kobliner, Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. And joining us today also is Kurt Kuhn. He's the chief financial officer for UPS, who I assume also just made it through a busy shipping day. Good morning, Kurt and Beth.
Good morning.
Morning.
Kurt, you're joining us because of your very individual and very unique story on how you became the CFO of UPS. Maybe you can tell us you started out as a driver.
Yeah, I sure did. Some 32 years ago, I started off actually as a temporary peak season helper, which is the person that goes along with our drivers this time of year. And then in 2 days, got my first promotion with the company and became a driver and worked for the holiday season.
Within 2 days, you got your first promotion. Maybe you can explain to us some of the strategies that you used to get promoted up so quickly through the company.
Well, there wasn't much of a strategy on that initial promotion. I just showed up and worked hard, and, you know, as the growth continued, they needed to add drivers. But, no, I backed into a career with UPS. I was out of college and really had no intention to make it a career, but started working for the holidays for UPS, and it was great fun. You know, you're Santa's helper, and there seemed to be a good fit between
me and the company, and over the long term, I've been able to move up slowly but surely through the ranks.
And you're chief financial officer. You're practically Santa now, pal.
That's it.
Well, we hope.
All our drivers out there are Santa right now. They're the ones that are busy. So.
Beth, this is not a typical story.
No, unfortunately, but it's a great lesson to learn. In that right now, seasonal hiring is actually up 37% from last year.
So, Kurt, how many are you hiring this year?
We're expecting about 50,000 peak season hires. So we ramp up quite a bit because things get very busy in December.
I bet. So, Beth, 50,000 people.
Right. And I think, as Kurt pointed out, he was in college. He took a job. There's really no shame in taking a temporary job that you think may perhaps not be your ideal job, but something you might want just for the holidays. And if you work hard and treat it like an audition, it might actually end up being a full-time job. People have been describing seasonal jobs as like the ER of the workplace because it's tense, it's busy, it's pressured, but if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. So if you prove yourself to your boss, it's not just a one-hour job interview, but a couple of weeks' worth of work. If you work hard, you can really show your stuff. And clearly, that's what this fellow did.
Obviously, UPS is not going to hire 50,000 people to a permanent position, right, Kurt? You're not going to hire all these people?
No, I mean, we'd love to, but unless the economy picks up incredibly, we won't need everybody.
So, Beth, what specifically can someone do
right, to
become maybe the one out of 50,000 or right, the two out of 50,000?
Right. Well, hiring is hopefully expected to increase in 2010, and that's why right now is such a good time to be considering a seasonal job and trying to jump on catering, retail companies. Even if you look on websites, UPS has openings still, Toys R Us, Macy's, Amazon, Michaels, Best Buy, all those companies have openings right now. You go to snagajob.com, coolworks.com, and even temp agencies. They're all looking for people to work.
Okay, Kurt, tell me what out of these 50,000 people, tell me what might convince you to retain one of them into a permanent position.
Well, I think, managers look for employees with enthusiasm and dedication. And so, doing the work you're asked and also looking to do more helps you stand out. And also there's a good cultural fit. That's what happened with me. I enjoyed the work, and over time, the company has a promotion from within policy, and so as I grew, they actually sent me back to school. So I think it's work hard, keep a good attitude, and do whatever, you can do to help out during this crazy time of year.
Well, and listening to Kurt and at UPS, it's really about productivity and enthusiasm and being sort of part of the production. But how do you deal with, like, the retail seasonal work that you're dealing in a situation where it's really hard to stand out? Is anybody looking at your quota if you're in retail over at the Gap this season?
I think they are. I really think they are. I think people are paying attention. One thing I've learned in the workplace is that when you're a good worker, it stands out. It's a shock, but it really does stand out. And I think right now, the reality, of course, is, this is an upbeat story, but the reality is that a number of people are working part-time because they don't want to. They want full-time jobs. So you're going to be in a situation, you're working part-time, you get the seasonal job, but you'll be competing. In fact, in 2007, there were 4.5 million people working part-time who were called involuntary workers who wanted to work full-time. This year, there are 9 million people who are working part-time and want to be full-time workers. So there will be a lot of competition for that job. So not only do you have to stand out, you really have to stand out and make it clear this is something you want.
That's Beth Kobliner, always has great advice for everyone. She's a Takeaway contributor and author of Get a Financial Life, Personal Finance in Your 20s and 30s. Also, Kurt Kuhn, Chief Financial Officer for UPS. Thanks to both of you. If you have a story and tips on turning a temp job into a full-time job, let us know your story. We're already getting some good ideas from listeners on the Facebook page. Mike writes, "Do it the way business loves, except a low-pay full-time freelance gig with no benefits." I think that's sarcastic. Geraldine writes, "You got to show up early, look good, and make everyone love you if you want to turn a temporary job into a permanent one. It's a lot of work to get work." Let us know your story on Facebook or at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Which is how you can reach us all week to tell us about your life in fine print. Our series looks at the little things that add up to a lot out of your wallet and in your behaviors. What have you noticed in your own life?
Worse than fine print was no print. We received travel vouchers from Delta a year or so ago. 13 months later, I go to book a flight. They tell me it's no good. Why? It expires in 12 months. Nowhere on the voucher does it say that. It does tell you to visit Delta.com. That's where you find out that it has a one-year life.
That's real fine print, stuff you can't even see. What's your story today? We talk about the little fees like ATM charges, but what's your strategy for avoiding them, and when have you run into them? What's the pitfall in your life? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to, you know where, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and this is Bold Print, The Takeaway. Mr. Mayor of New York starts spreading the news.
We're also working with cities across the nation and around the world, learning from their experiences. And we're urging, in no uncertain terms, stronger, clearer national leadership on global warming as well.
At the climate talks in Copenhagen, Mayor Michael Bloomberg picks up a message he's been sending for years. All environmentalism is local. On global warming, he's living for the cities. Michael Bloomberg on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning on Tuesday, December 15th. The Takeaway is, are cities enough trying to lead by example or make a difference on global warming? I mean, does local action beat global warming?
Well, you know, growing up as a kid who watched Jimmy Carter put his cardigan on in the White House, I learned that global warming, fighting global warming begins at home. Not even in the cities.
Well, you're dating yourself, but that's great. I remember that moment.
Let's get right to it, though. New economic numbers just out in the past half hour. The Labor Department says wholesale prices jumped 1.8% last month. That's more than double what analysts expected. The increase is certain to raise the attention of Federal Reserve policymakers as they begin a two-day meeting on interest rates today. First, the public option came and went. Now, the plan to expand Medicare may be dropped as well. The idea of letting people ages 55 to 64 buy into the program was reportedly abandoned during a closed-door meeting between Democratic senators last night, one day after it drew fire from Senator Joe Lieberman. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to David Kirkpatrick of The New York Times, who says Lieberman is holding all the cards this morning.
So far, it looks like Joe Lieberman won, everyone else nothing.
President Obama will meet with all Senate Democrats later today to discuss ways to pass a health care bill by Christmas.
As heads of states and government begin to arrive at the conference in Copenhagen on climate change, nearly 200 arrests were made overnight as authorities used tear gas to disperse crowds of protesters. We're about to talk to New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who is at the Copenhagen conference, in just a moment. BBC Environment reporter Matt McGraw is in Copenhagen. He joined us early this morning, and we asked him who's already there.
There's 45,000 delegates have actually been registered for this conference. The conference center can hold 15,000, so there's been massive queues outside of people trying to get in. Yesterday, people queuing for 9 hours. There's all range of people here, from small countries, delegations from small countries, to people as with weird titles like SupremeMasterTV.org, handing out leaflets about veganism as you come in here as a way of saving the planet. So yes, it's a great collection of all the weird and the wonderful, as well as the absolutely sincere political and negotiators here as well.
And the very serious North-South issues that have stymied the conference for the last couple of days, that's moving forward now again?
The negotiations are back on track. They're moving forward here, and yes, the negotiators are back in the session. Big problem for them, of course, is time. Can the leaders make the decisions in time? They've only got a couple of days left.
And the real big shots are arriving. That's BBC Environment reporter Matt McGraw, speaking with us earlier this morning from the climate summit in Copenhagen.
The White House is expected to announce today plans to turn a state prison into rural Illinois into the new home for some 100 terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay. That decision will bring new jobs to Thompson, Illinois, which is about 150 miles outside of Chicago. That comes as a New York Times poll this morning found half of the unemployed Americans say they suffered anxiety or depression in the past year. Kevin Roach is executive director of the South Oakland Homeless Shelter in Michigan. Speaking earlier on The Takeaway, he says one big change recently has been the number of newly unemployed needing to use the shelter that he runs.
Roughly this past year, it's been about 45% of all of our clients who were first-time homeless.
The poll also found more than half of unemployed people have borrowed money from friends or relatives.
Asian markets ended lower. European indices are down. Wall Street futures are down, responding to the inflation numbers. The Dow gets underway at 10,501.
Coming up, we're going to speak with New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg about what local leaders need to do to solve the worldwide problem like climate change. And we're asking you, how do you solve the problem of ATM fees and fine print on the back of your credit cards? We're asking you all this week about life in fine print. How do you survive? 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. I loved Matt McGraw there at the BBC setting the scene for us. Tens of thousands of people in Copenhagen standing in line, queuing up, as he says.
With their own little individual websites and brochures.
Indeed. It's our understanding, though, that the mayor of New York did not queue in any lines this morning at Copenhagen.
No.
We can't totally confirm that, but that's our understanding. He's taken the can-do attitude he brings to City Hall in New York to the Copenhagen climate talks, where can't-do and stalemate have seemed to be the headlines for the last couple of days. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is attending that Copenhagen conference as part of a summit of mayors. Is all environmentalism local? Can local political activism on environmental issues combat global warming? Michael Bloomberg says yes, to a point. Mayor Bloomberg, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's a little bit chilly in Copenhagen, but probably chilly in New York as well.
Indeed. Actually, it's a little bit warm here. It's going to cool down tomorrow, but enough of the weather. Let's talk about what you've said on a number of occasions. I can recall a speech you gave back in 2008 where you said the United States needs to lead by example to have an impact on global warming. Do you think we're doing that, and how is that reflected in your work at the climate change conference?
Well, I think it's cities that are going to lead national governments to do something, and national governments have to help each other, and America has always been the country that sets the standard for the whole world and leads by example, and so it is incumbent on our federal government to do something, but it's the cities where the mayors have to make sure that their economies aren't choked by congestion. It's the cities where the mayors have to make sure that the public doesn't have to breathe pollutants in the air into their lungs. And so, yes, we have to lead by example, but even if nobody paid attention elsewhere, I think we have an obligation to do something and the ability to do something. And in New York, we just passed a green buildings bill, which will require, for example, landlords to post what the energy uses in their buildings are on the internet. Then tenants that might want to locate into those buildings, or buyers for those buildings, or lenders to the owners of those buildings, can see whether those buildings are energy efficient. In the end, all these things help ourselves.
Mayor Bloomberg, one of the issues is political. And when you came into office nearly a decade ago, you really put a moratorium on the recycling program in the city of New York and refocused it and then brought it back. First of all, you were criticized for doing that.
With everything, you can always do it better, and times change and you should look at new ways of doing it. But you also have to be realistic in terms of the economy and jobs and what society can afford. And so if, for example, recycling is not the best use of your dollars to improve the environment, do something else for a while. If recycling the way we did it in the past is not economically viable, but there is another ways to make it economically viable, there's no harm in changing that. And I've always thought that if you really want to make change, you have to bring things back to people's self-interest today. So, for example, we all care about housing and jobs. My house, my job. And that's fine. That's what we should be doing. So if you can make it, if people can understand that if they were, for example, change the light bulbs in their house or their apartment, they will reduce their energy bills overnight. If they were to paint the roofs of their houses or apartments white, they would reduce their energy bill dramatically overnight. Then they'll do that, and there are longer term and more global benefits. But in the end, a company is going to do what's in the interest of its shareholders.
Right.
So if you can show the company that they can save money by being more ecologically friendly, or if they can recruit a better workforce, it has a lot of benefits in doing it short term. And then I'll take the long term stuff. That's great. That's where we really have to do it. But the ways you're going to get it done is to make people understand short term, local, right in their own backyard, right in their own house,
right,
they can make the world better.
You know, we've been hearing voices from around the world all week long as Copenhagen has been taking place. And young children in India were commenting on this program yesterday about how the United States has an unfair amount of carbon that it puts into the environment purely by virtue of its luxury and standard of living. Are you vulnerable as a mayor of New York on that?
I don't know that Americans are a bad example. New York City, for example, is one of the most environmentally friendly cities in the world per capita because of our density and because more people walk and take mass transit than virtually any place else. And most of our pollutants come from buildings and not from
transportation. But regardless, we should sit here and not worry about what anybody else is doing. We should do our part to make our world, particularly the part of the world we live in, better. And it is clearly true that more developed countries, in many senses, use more energy and therefore are more polluting. But that doesn't mean that less developed countries should aspire to be as big polluters as we are. In fact, they have an opportunity to get the development in a much more efficient way. So what we have to do is, yes, India has to develop, and yes, India wants for its people the same things we have for us. But while we're trying to bring our use of carbon products and pollution down, as they develop their economy, they should try not to raise it, and we'll both wind up in a great place.
Mayor, we've seen the agreements in Copenhagen get stalled by some pretty complicated political issues between countries, and we've seen states like California bypassing Copenhagen altogether to get some environmental agreements. Which is more effective? Do you think in the end that cities and states are going to have to bypass this political international political stage?
Well, I've always believed whether it's changing the environment or controlling crime or improving public education, all of the big issues that face us, most of them are issues where, in the end, it is cities and city governments that make the difference. And that's partly because the mayors are closer to the people day in and day out. You know, I take the subway every day. I hear what people's concerns are. I walk the streets. I shake hands with anybody and everybody. And then as you move up towards state and then finally get to the federal government level, they are, maybe for security reasons or a variety of other things, more removed from the day in and day out interests of the people. The reason that mayors typically don't go on to higher offices is they have to make decisions. The public looks at them and says, I want that garbage cleaned up and I want it done efficiently. I want to reduce my energy bill in my apartment or my house today. And those are done much more at the city level.
Right.
And that's why mayors are much more of an operations kind of person, whereas governors and presidents tend to be more of legislative kinds of functions,
right,
even in the executive branch.
Well, I'll come at it one more time on this sort of lead-by-example idea. Does that mean you're going to fly commercial home from Copenhagen, Mr. Mayor, the way you use private jets?
No, I'm taking a bunch of people, but you know, the small carbon footprint that the plane generates in return for getting the opportunity to come here and to perhaps get lots of cities to follow New York's lead and for New York to learn from other cities. You know, a lot of what we do in New York City, we've learned from other cities. For example, I'm here in the City Hall in Copenhagen, and our new program to close Broadway and Times Square and Herald Square, which has reduced traffic accidents, pedestrian accidents dramatically, which has improved traffic and certainly helped tourism and business in the area, that came from ideas that we saw here in Copenhagen.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Mayor Mike Bloomberg with the Vagabond Jews, mayor of New York at the Climate Talks in Copenhagen.
These little town blues are melting away.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some headlines.
President Obama visits Virginia today to push his plan to make homes more energy efficient. The president says doing so will create jobs and save people money on their energy bills. Also on the president's agenda today, more meetings with Senate Democrats to try and give health care reform more momentum. News is coming in of a powerful car bomb in central Pakistan. It's killed more than 20 people and is close to where the army is carrying out a major offensive against the Taliban. And finally, here's something we found for you this morning. Reports from Japan say a railway company is to install special cameras on its Tokyo commuter trains. The idea is to deal with a long-standing problem in Japan of groping on public transport. The cameras are to be fixed on the ceiling of carriages on trains, notorious for men who like to get a little too close. Those are some of the stories that we're following.
It's like someone's idea of a website.
Please don't say that. Some of the stories are, I don't even want to think about
Japanese,
that. Shots of me on a website somewhere, writing on the subway. Coming up, how do you stop your Christmas tree from shedding needles on your living room floor?
Hey, you want that to go?
Good morning, everyone. A trio of news takeouts this morning. The story we want to be on top of first, of course, is health care reform. In response to Senator Joe Lieberman, who has balked at the Democrats' so-called compromise, your colleague down there in Washington, Todd Zwillick, David Kirkpatrick of the New York Times, described what Harry Reid is doing as a reverse auction, lowering the bar until senators jump on board. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, what's going on with the health care reform today with Harry Reid?
Yeah, I think Kirkpatrick's right, John. I'm describing this a little bit differently. I'm saying this bill is getting a little bit, a lot more aerodynamic so that it can slide through the Senate before Christmas. That's the imperative now, seems to be speed. Last night, the Senate Democrats met in a caucus. Yesterday evening around dinner time, this was the first time all the Democrats got together with Joe Lieberman after he said on television on Sunday that he didn't like the Medicare buy-in. We know he doesn't like the public option. And then it appears when they came out of this meeting that the Medicare buy-in is out, and it appears that the public option is out. I want to set the scene for you real quickly.
The Medicare buy-in, that's the 55-year-olds get to buy into Medicare, right?
Exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
They get to buy in to try to give them some public insurance. Max Baucus, chairman of the Finance Committee, came out of that meeting, an absolute swarm of us on top of him to find out if the Medicare buy-in and the public option are out. Here's Baucus.
That's the direction we're heading toward. I do not want to say that categorically, but it's heading in that direction. Anything can change around here. But right now, that's how it looks.
So not even Medicare is a public option.
Not even Medicare is a public option. Now, where this bill is headed is still a little bit unclear. Nobody's inside Harry Reid's head exactly what he's going to do. The Senate Democrats are going to the White House this afternoon to meet with the president. The mission here being to get this bill passed by Christmas. And there's some nuance going on in the Senate real quickly, John, that's important. I want to point you to Roland Burris, a liberal, who has said all along, he's been one of these people, I will only vote for a bill that has a public option in it. Right after this meeting last night, he got on the floor and said, I will only vote for a bill that has the goals of the public option in it. You see the difference?
Yep.
They're starting to move towards getting rid of this thing.
All right. Well, you've got the House and the Senate. Maybe there needs to be a special chamber just for Joe Lieberman. Thank you, Todd.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
For our next takeout, we're going to go to Professor Gary Chastagner of Washington State University. And we are talking to this professor today because his nickname is Mr. Christmas Tree. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
You have been studying the Christmas tree for the past 30 years.
That's correct.
There's about 15 or so species of trees that we think of as Christmas trees, right?
Yes.
And your problem with them right now is that they shed needles all over the living room floor.
Well, certainly some species do, and a number of consumer surveys by the National Christmas Tree Association have shown that needle loss is a concern that consumers commonly have.
So how do you genetically modify these trees so they stop doing the shedding the needles?
No, we're taking advantage of the natural genetic variation that occurs within these species, and the key has been that we've been able to use a small detached branch test to identify trees that don't shed.
Gary, is it too much to ask that when you bring a plant into your home, you put up with maybe the shedding of its leaves?
Well, certainly some of it may occur, but in some cases it can be pretty severe, and we're trying to eliminate the severe needle shedding that can occur with some species.
Severe needle shedding means? What constitutes severe needle shedding?
Well, a tree might have 200 or 300,000 needles on it, and if you had 10% of those fall off the tree, that would be pretty severe.
Okay, so when are we going to see these Christmas trees that don't leave a mess on the floor?
Well, some of them are already into seed orchards, which means that they'll be producing seed, and that seed will be available to growers to plant. And so within probably 7 to 8 years. In the meantime, consumers can display trees in water, and that's a very effective way to minimize a needle shedding problem.
Okay, Professor Gary A. Chastagner, Washington State University, maybe next up in a natural tree that comes with tinsel and lighting already on it.
And our takeout number three is about sports, where it's holiday time.
Swing and a miss. Big time punch out for Roy Halladay.
Roy Halladay, the pitcher for the Toronto Blue Jays, will go to the Philadelphia Phillies in a complicated deal. They're moving the pieces around on the chessboard in baseball. Gary Belsky joins us, editor-in-chief of ESPN Magazine. Good morning, Gary.
Hey, how are you?
This is a complicated deal, but what's the headline?
The headline is the defending National League champions got rid of one very good pitcher in exchange for another very good pitcher because they didn't want to pay their original very good pitcher as much money as they as the Yankees paid their very good pitcher, CC Sabathia.
So the Phillies are betting, it's a money issue for the Phillies, but Roy Halladay seems to be betting that he's going to be in the World Series. He wants to be on a championship team.
Well, Roy Halladay is the best pitcher in baseball to have never pitched even an inning of the postseason, and so he's thinking that the defending National League champions have a decent chance of getting back to the World Series this year exactly, and certainly to get into the postseason at least. My favorite is that everybody refers now to CC Sabathia money as if he's got his own country and is issuing currency.
Now, that's because Sabathia did so well. That trade worked out so well for the Yankees.
But the reason the Phillies, which is interesting for, I think, everybody who's listening, is that the Phillies were willing to pay a lot of money for a good pitcher. They just don't want to do what the Yankees did, which was commit to 5 or 6 or 7 years. They believe, probably smartly, that you don't want to commit to pitching, no matter how good it is, for longer than 3 years, ideally. And so Halladay was willing to allow that deal to happen because he was willing to sort of gamble on going to a very good team, even if it's a shorter contract than he could have gotten.
Well, gamble, there's also a bit of desperation. I mean, he is 32 years old, 4 years. I mean, he better do something.
Oh, my God, 32, your career's already over? I am so gone. But, yeah, exactly. That's what he was thinking about,
well,
I think.
Well, pitchers. What's he like in terms of 9-inning games, 8-inning games, 6-inning games? What kind of a pitcher are we going to see in the Phillies?
He's good in every inning, and he's a class guy and a professional and can finish games and has an assortment of pitches, and he's just somebody that you want to have on your team if you're going to make another run, and the Phillies are obviously intent on making another run. They have arguably one of the two or three best position players in baseball and one of the three or four of the 15 best position players in baseball. So this makes sense for them, and it makes sense for their philosophy.
And the number one position in the sports commentary is Gary Belsky, editor-in-chief of ESPN Magazine. He's right here on The Takeaway. Thanks, Gary.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we've known for some time that African Americans make up a disproportionate number of HIV and AIDS cases in the United States. One thing we have not known is why the black church leaders have not stepped forward to say something about this crisis. We're going to talk about a change in attitude among black church leaders in just a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The proposed expansion of Medicare appears to be sinking this morning. The idea of letting people ages 55 to 64 buy into the program was reportedly dropped during a closed-door meeting between Democratic senators last night. Senator Max Baucus says he's still confident, though, that they'll get the job done.
Sure, as I'm standing here, I am very confident. I know that we're going to pass health care insurance for all Americans within a matter of a couple of weeks.
President Obama is looking for a little team unity. He's called every Senate Democrat to the White House today to discuss ways to pass a health care bill by Christmas. Democrats need all of their 60 votes to stop any Republican stalling tactics.
A stall in Pakistan on the detention and deportation of those five Americans being held on suspicion of militant links. Pakistani court has granted police another 10 days to question those men. The D.C. area men were detained last week in central Pakistan. Climate talks in Copenhagen have reached the home stretch. Earlier this hour, we spoke with New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's in Copenhagen as part of a summit of city mayors. He says New York is doing its share to combat climate change.
We just passed a green buildings bill, which will require, for example, landlords to post what the energy uses in their buildings are on the internet.
Full interview with the mayor of New York at thetakeaway.org. The Golden Globe nominations were announced last hour. Up in the Air led the way with 6, including Best Picture and Best Actor for George Clooney. Here's a scene where Clooney's character talks about his main goal in life, racking up 10 million frequent flyer miles.
I'd be the 7th person to do it. More people have walked on the moon.
Did they throw you a parade?
You get lifetime executive status. You get to meet the chief pilot, Maynard Finch.
Wow.
And they put your name on the side of a plane.
If you guys don't grow up, it's like you need to pee on everything.
They'll hand out the Golden Globes next month. Also announced last hour, the Labor Department says wholesale prices jumped 1.8% last month. That's more than double what analysts expected, and it is moving the markets. The Dow is down about 35 points at this hour, and similar declines. The NASDAQ down 8 points, and the S&P down about 5 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, we've known for quite some time, as I said earlier, that African Americans make up a disproportionate number of HIV and AIDS cases in the United States. The percentages go this way. African Americans are about 12% of the total population in the U.S., but they account for 51% of HIV and AIDS cases. And you would think that black church leaders would be on the forefront of the fight against this particular statistic. However, until now, black church leaders have opposed AIDS activism. Presumably, that's part of their almost universal opposition to gay relationships. That presumably has changed. The National Black Leadership Commission is led by African-American clergy. They convened in Detroit yesterday to draw attention to this very issue, and they also want to promote a congressional bill that they think will help slow infections in at-risk communities. We're joined now by Reverend Horace Sheffield of the New Galilee Baptist Church in Detroit and head of the Detroit chapter on the National AIDS Commission. Good morning, Reverend.
Good morning.
And from Atlanta, Jordan, Dazon Dixon Diallo is the founder and president of Sister Love. That's a women's HIV, AIDS, and reproductive justice organization. Welcome to you.
Good morning, Celeste. Thank you for having me.
Reverend, you described the attitude of black clergy members towards this issue of HIV and AIDS among the black community as woefully silent. I'm wondering if you could explain what you mean by that.
Well, I believe that in the African-American context or congregational context, we've been content on a variety of issues to change circumstances and not change conditions. And therefore, this has been ascribed as a moral issue, as a lapse of judgment, a variety of things, which then in some people's minds justifies no response at all. The face of AIDS has changed. African-American women are most at risk. People who are heterosexual are at an alarming rate contracting HIV/AIDS, and therefore the church cannot sit idly by and do nothing.
So you believe the church has changed its attitude? Or are you hoping to bring more black leaders in?
Well, you know, we've gotten a good number of clergy across the country, Bishop T.D. Jakes and Kelvin Butts in New York and others across the country now recognize that if we don't address this issue, this pandemic, all of the other things that we're concerning ourselves with won't even matter because we won't be here.
Dazon Dixon Diallo from Atlanta, Georgia, can you tell me, do you agree that the black church is a little bit late coming to this issue, and can you explain a little bit what the delay has been caused by?
Sure. I would actually go beyond that and say that they're more than a little bit late coming to the issue, because the epidemic of HIV has actually been in our community since the beginning of the epidemic. We just had a different kind of presence in the public because of the way AIDS was introduced in our own country as mostly related to white gay men. I think that part of the challenge going forward is that, as Reverend Sheffield has just said, of course, African-American women and heterosexuals in the African-American community are at a growing at an alarming rate. However, we still have to recognize that the largest proportion of even folks in the black community who are living with HIV and AIDS are young and middle or more middle-aged men who have sex with men. And so I think that even it's a great thing that the faith leaders are coming to the table, but I think it's going to be an important struggle for them to not just be able to tackle AIDS from a comfortable position of focusing on women and children or on heterosexuals, but these faith leaders are also going to have to really come to the plate and figure out how to address the issue of men who have sex with men and their partners from the pulpit and within their congregation.
Reverend Sheffield, are you prepared with your group to address exactly what Dazon is talking about, the issue of gay relationships in the African-American community?
Well, I think that I've already mentioned, and I tried to, in the notion of concept of changing conditions and not changing circumstances, address that. Our focus is not just on women who are at risk or young people, but all people in our community everywhere who are at risk. So, no, I don't have a problem with that. In fact, I have a completely liberal and sometimes often ostracized congregation because I don't think that sexual orientation is even an issue that Jesus addressed. The real question is, what do we do about folks who are hurting? The lepers of the day of Jesus were not necessarily acceptable. They were socially ostracized, yet Jesus identified exactly with people who the mainstream society didn't want anything to do with. So, no, I don't have a problem with MSMs or whoever it is, whoever's hurting, whoever's at risk. Those are the people we have to address and help, and we've got to stop the spiraling spread of HIV/AIDS among all populations within the African-American community.
Dazon, you've been working with this issue for a long time. Can this plan that Reverend Sheffield and his colleagues have to get a congressional bill, can that help slow the rate of infection?
I absolutely think that any increased effort in the community, especially where the epidemic is hitting hardest, will have to help us. But I also want to encourage the black leadership, especially the faith leaders, as Reverend Sheffield just said, is to focus beyond behaviors on a lot of the conditions, the social determinants that actually help exacerbate the epidemic in our communities: poverty, housing, violence, racism, sexism, homophobia, that we have to be addressing the conditions in the environment as well. He's absolutely right.
Okay, well, I think the Reverend will probably be addressing those issues from his own pulpit at the New Galilee Baptist Church in Detroit. Thank you, Reverend Horace Sheffield. He heads the Detroit chapter of the National Black Leadership Commission on AIDS. And Dazon Dixon Diallo is the founder and president of Sister Love. That's a women's HIV/AIDS and reproductive justice organization in Atlanta, Georgia. Coming up, your life in fine print. Little words can have big consequences. We're going to talk about that in just a few minutes.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Congratulations are in order. This year, Army Specialist Clancy Henderson came out on top. He was honored as 2009's Soldier of the Year. This comes out of a competition that's called the Army's Best Warrior. Specialist Henderson joins us now. Welcome to the program and congratulations. So tell us, what did you have to do to win Soldier of the Year?
You start out at the lowest level, which is at the company level, and you have to compete all the way and win every time to get up to the Department of the Army. I think I went through a total of 8 competitions.
8 times you had to do these particular contests?
That's right. There were a number of events, hand-to-hand combat. The land navigation was very interesting because we had to learn a little bit of Arabic to navigate the course as well.
You've been in the Army for 2 years?
Yep.
And how long do you plan to remain in the services?
Until I die.
And you're going to...
Hopefully it's not anytime soon.
So tell me, besides this title, Soldier of the Year, what else do you walk away with?
They do hand out a few prizes. they gave me my own AR-15, a couple of rifles, actually. You get some gift certificates, and there's actually a lot of sponsors that participate and, make it worthwhile for the competitors that go through a lot in order to get here and to win.
Now, have you been deployed either to Iraq or Afghanistan?
I have not. I spent a year in Korea, and actually early next year I'll be going to Iraq.
Now, are you worried that once you get into Baghdad and are on patrol, that the fact that you're, like, Soldier of the Year with the way that they, can bust your chops over there, that that's going to be a liability?
I wouldn't think so. I know my command has confidence in me and the other soldiers that I work with, and I wouldn't think it would be an issue at all.
We've reported on this program the spiking suicide rate of returning soldiers, the PTSD issues. How do you, as a soldier, as somebody, anticipating deployment, prepare for dealing with those kinds of things?
All the soldiers who prepare to deploy go through rigorous analysis and different assessments, mentally and physically, in order to make sure that they're prepared to go over there. And in order to compare, because they'll go through the same set when they return, and to see what the difference is and to see if that specific soldier or individual needs help somehow to make sure that those issues get addressed.
Now, listen, I'm listening to the way you talk, and Celeste and I have talked about this on the program a lot, that there is a concern in the military, traditionally, that if you raise a hand on mental health issues, you've got a stigma attached to you. I don't hear any sense of that in your voice. Is that a generational shift?
People talk about that stigma a lot, but every brief I've been to, every counseling session that someone's invited, soldiers to go to, I've always heard them say that it's never an issue, and I've never seen it be one. Having some of my friends, my 2 brothers are in, and obviously I have a lot of associates that I serve with, and anybody that I've ever seen go through a counseling session or say, hey, I have an issue and I need to talk to somebody, never seen negative action on that person. It's always been nothing but support from the command and the people that they deal with.
You joined the services, though, 2 years ago, so maybe, as John said, this is a change in generations between among our servicemen.
That's possible. But like I said, my brothers are in as well, and from them, they've been in a few more years than I have. Never heard anything about it, but maybe it's just something that they say in order to avoid it.
Army Specialist Clancy Henderson is the U.S. Army's 2009 Soldier of the Year. He won the competition that's called the Army's Best Warrior. Congratulations to him.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Good morning, everyone. We're all doing it, living in the fine print. Here's Ben's story about the fine print in his Citibank account.
We are going to be billed for a checking account usage, which we never had before. So obviously, we are paying back the stimulus.
How does your life change when you take a look at the fine print in your life? We're talking about it all week long on our series, Living in the Fine Print. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. The White House set to unveil plans to bring terror suspects to rural Illinois. And officials are expected to confirm later that the government will buy a local correctional center that could house as many as 100 detainees from Guantanamo Bay. President Obama is summoning all Senate Democrats to the White House today for a strategy session on the nearly $1 trillion health care overhaul. A Senate vote is set later today on importing prescription drugs.
The president will also take a visit to Virginia today. He'll be promoting his plan to make homes more energy efficient. And finally, Australian scientists have discovered an octopus which collects coconut shells to hide in. The octopuses, that's the correct plural of octopus, were observed selecting suitably sized coconut shells from the seafloor and clearing them out. They then combined two shells to make a hiding place. Here's researcher Dr. Mark Norman.
A relative of a snail, these octopuses, they're not simple animals.
Norman says this may be the first evidence of intelligent use of tools by an invertebrate. Those are
snails.
Some of the stories.
Snails. Snails.
Yeah. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
I've been wasting all my time with the devil and the details.
Devil, details, fine print, our series on life in the fine print. It's a characteristic of the 21st century, getting more vigilant about the little things in the fine print in all aspects of what we do in America. What is the fine print all about?
The idea of the fine print is not to help the customer. The idea of the fine print is to be able to hide things that will fool people.
Well, that was the assessment yesterday from Elizabeth Warren, the chair of the congressional panel that oversees TARP money, the bank bailout. She told us we should all be vigilant about fine print because it is there deliberately to fool us. And we've already gotten some responses from listeners like you.
Simple. There have to be laws in place to protect the consumer. There have to be strong laws. If not, these banks and mortgage companies and credit card companies are going to do what they plan to do, which is to prey on the weak, prey on the poor. There have to be laws that prevent that. And criminal prosecutions, too, not just civil penalties that are paid by the corporation. Put these people in jail.
It's a morality play, good and evil being played out in the fine print of your bank statement. Here to talk about it is Louise Story, Wall Street and finance writer for the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
And Glinda Bridgeforth is president and CEO of Bridgeforth Financial and Associates. She's also the author of the Girl Financial series of books, including Girl, Get Your Credit Straight. She joins us from Detroit. Good morning, Glinda.
Good morning.
So let's talk about this, Louise. First of all, there's a bit of everything in your fees, in your bank statement, is actually legal, right? In almost every case.
They do disclose a lot of things in fine print in your statement.
And so the fact that they disclose it sort of makes it legal in some sense. So the whole business model behind bank fees seems to me a part of a psychological game, that if they know, if they bet we won't pay attention, they're able to get the money out of us, even if they're not actually charging us for something that costs them money. I mean, an ATM fee, how much does that actually cost a bank to process an ATM transaction?
So it's interesting. ATM has become is a growing boondoggle for these banks. They're charging $2, $3 if a stranger uses their ATM. And then, this is one I didn't know about till I started digging into this research. Also, many banks charge their own customers an additional fee. So if I go use, you know, J.P. Morgan's ATM, for instance, and I'm not a J.P. Morgan customer, J.P. Morgan charges me and my own bank charges me for going elsewhere.
And they do it just because they can. I mean, Glinda Bridgeforth, I was thinking this morning, okay, how many ATM transactions I do in the course of a year, multiplied by $1.50, $2, in some cases $3, I got scared and I didn't want to do the calculation. That's what consumers are faced with, right?
Absolutely. It's a situation where, you know, these small amounts of money certainly do add up, and you're a lot like most people. We get frightened by the number, and then we don't do it. We don't look at it. We try not to think about it. I really do feel that there is a personal responsibility that we have to identify the various areas where we're being charged. And if people would just manage their checkbooks better, if people would just use a check register and write down money as it goes in and money as it comes out, then I think that they'll be in a much better position and they'll be able to see what's going on in terms of the fee. And very often, as they see these fees adding up, then they'll automatically stop.
Now, banks don't treat customers, Louise Story, like they necessarily treat businesses. I mean, if I was a small business and I went to my bank and said, look at all these fees, come on, can't we do something different? They'd be more likely or less likely to negotiate with me as a business than me as just a regular old consumer.
Most consumers offer very little individual value to the banks. You know, often people only have $400 in their checking account, for instance, at any given moment. So that's not a high ticket thing for the banks. They're not that likely to negotiate. What's going on right now that's interesting is that it's really going to be regulation and new laws that are going to push banks on what fees they can charge. And this is good and bad because there can be unintended consequences. So you've probably heard about the Fed last month banned overdraft fees
right
on ATM and debit card purchases that went over your limit. However, they didn't ban them on checking overdrafts. And so a lot of people out there might have heard that they banned overdraft fees and might not be worried about their checking account, but it was not banned there. There's legislation pending there. The other thing that we might see is as the banks are prohibited from certain types of fees by the Fed or by Congress, they will look for other places. That's part of the reason that bank analysts think these ATM fees are going up, because the banks can't make money in one corner.
So
they look
whack-a-mole.
Elsewhere.
It's whack-a-mole.
That's right.
Interesting. Glenda Bridgeforth, what is a low-income person to do to fight back against fees when almost anything they do at a bank is going to cost them a fee?
Well, one thing that they can do is they can look at debit cards. For instance, there is the debit card, like the prepaid reloadable debit card. That way, what you have is a debit card that you can use just like a Visa card, and you can use it anywhere, and it can be purchased at, say, Walmart. There's a very fine card called Green Dot that you can purchase at CVS, at Rite Aid, and so forth, many other locations. But purchasing this card is a good way to make sure that you stay within the amount of money that you have, because it won't let you take out more money than you've put in.
Are there fees associated with these kind of cards?
Well, often prepaid cards have had a whole roster of fees that are hidden, and this has been another big concern among consumer advocates. But the whack-a-mole analogy is very key. Another place that I think we're going to see rising fees that everyone should watch out for is on their checking accounts. Checking accounts have been free for a while, but we're already seeing banks changing the fine print there.
Lastly, is their credit unions exempt from this? People often feel that their credit unions are beneficent institutions.
So surveys have shown, there's a survey by Moeb Services, for instance, and it's shown that the larger banks tend to charge higher fees, and the credit unions do tend, on average, for each of these things to charge lower
fees.
Interesting.
Louise Story, Wall Street and finance writer for the New York Times, our partner, the New York Times. Glenda Bridgeforth, is personal responsibility an antidote to the fine print sort of fees that are yanking our chains and our wallets quickly?
I feel that it is, and I think that we need to schedule a mind your own business day. And this is a day where we sit down, we pay our bills, we read the fine print, we read the inserts that are included in our bills. And if we do that, then I think that we're able to make some informed decisions in terms of what we might need to do to change and avoid fees.
Well, there's a great takeaway. Glenda Bridgeforth, President and CEO of Bridgeforth Financial and Associates. Schedule a mind your own business day. Thanks for that. So what is your strategy on this whole question of living in the fine print for avoiding those little charges? How do you become vigilant? How do you monitor your own behavior? Tell us your stories at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Our series continues tomorrow when we talk about what to watch for in mortgage agreements. You may talk about fine print.
And pages and pages and pages of it.
You may think you've learned what to watch for after foreclosures sucked so many Americans, but there's a second wave of foreclosures coming. We'll talk about how you can avoid being one of them. That's tomorrow.
If you missed anything, like the interview earlier with New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, you can catch all of that on our website at thetakeaway.org. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.